Hey y'all, welcome back. Are you happy that I have a brand new episode for you? I hope you are because I definitely am. I have to say, it feels so good to get myself back on schedule and focused again. I'm doing what I can to order my steps with this podcast. I'm hyper aware of the good it can do in the world, and I want to continue doing my part. I have so many goals for this project, and really this is just the vehicle for what I really want to do, which is to provide resources for the families and victims I talk about here. Resources like private investigators, access to lawyers and publicists, and help for women and girls trying to escape human trafficking and domestic abuse. I know, it's a tall order, but listen, if other platforms like Crime Junkie can do it, then I know I damn sure can, and with us in mind. You feel me? I'm working to build this platform. So, with that said, I want to announce the launch of the official Massage Noir Murders website. This has been a long work in progress, but it's finally online, and I am just over the moon about it. I've worked with the amazing Simply Adara, a designer I found on Fiverr. And don't sleep on Fiverr because I have found so many great, amazing creators and artists and all sorts of people there for really affordable prices. And Adara is among them. Not only was she professional and obviously skilled, but she handled my vision and my podcast with care, intention, and she produced a simple yet elegant website for me. I highly recommend her for other creators out there looking to get their official website launched, and I definitely plan to work with her again. I did go ahead and link her details in the show notes just in case anyone else wants to reach out to her. Anyway, going forward, you will be able to listen to all my episodes directly on the site and see pictures associated with the victims along with all the source material. Of course, you can still listen on your favorite platform like Spotify and Apple Podcasts, but this is where all the additional content will be housed going forward. And eventually, I really would like to stream from there, which is not something that I've done so far. So there's just more to come with that whole project in general. And the most exciting part about that for me is soon there will be exclusive Massage Noir Murders merch available on the site. That is something that people have been asking me about for a while, and I got a lot of new requests for it as soon as people saw the new work. So stay tuned for that because it's finally a bridge that I'm ready to cross, and as soon as I have merch available, you'll be the first to know. And last but not least, thanks so much for the love you all showed for the new podcast logo and artwork. I'm so glad you all love it just as much as I do. And your feedback lets me know that you and I are in sync and we're on the same page, which is exactly what I want. After all, we are a community, and I want this to feel like that always. So thanks a million for all your continued support. Now, let's get into this new episode. Today's story takes us to the year 2009 in Dallas, Texas. Dallas, known not only for the city in which President John F. Kennedy was assassinated, but also for its rich Black history. Home to 1.2 million Black people, many of those residents are highly educated and value entrepreneurship. It's one of those great American cities. But just like with everything else, the city is not without its problems, and domestic violence and abuse is one of them. In 2018, the Dallas Domestic Violence Task Force reported that 153,417 family violence calls were placed to the Dallas Police Department Family Violence Unit. That was the highest in 5 years, as reported by the task force, and 150 women were killed at home in 2019 as a result of domestic violence. That was cited by Families to Freedom. The organization also posted a ton of other stats on their website, that included, but sadly aren't limited to, 4,379 domestic violence cases filed in Dallas, 5,815 Dallas sheltered victims and children in 2018, and 1,754 felony domestic violence cases presented to the grand jury in Dallas by 2018. Listen, these numbers are horrifying, and I only listed a few. There's a whole website full of these stats, all about domestic violence in Dallas or Texas in general. With horrifying numbers like these, I honestly don't even know what to think or make of any of it. All I can say is that there's a very serious problem with domestic violence in the city. And sadly, the story I have for you today is an awful example of the problem. I'm Renetta Rideout, and this is Massage Noir Murders. In the 9 o'clock hour of Monday night, September 21st, 2009, Latasha Bradfield sat in her living room watching TV with her family when someone banged on her door. She recalled in an interview for season 2 of the Discovery Investigation show, Evil Lives Here, Shadows of Death, The Monster, that it wasn't just a polite knock or even an overzealous one. No. Someone was beating on the door like their life depended on it. So she got up to see what the fuss was about. When she opened the door, in rushed two of her neighbor's children. It was 12-year-old Jerome, aka JT, and his 9-year-old brother Jared. The boys were in a panic, and JT was especially disturbed. He was crying uncontrollably while Jared spoke to someone on the phone. And let me not fail to mention that Jared's shirt was stained with blood. With so much going on, Latasha tried to wrap her head around the chaos that just burst through her door. She asked Jared who was on the phone, and he told her it was 911. Immediately, she took the phone from him and relayed to the dispatcher who she was and that she didn't know what was going on, but she would go to the kid's house, which was just next door, and check it out. She was so incredibly brave and selfless for that act because I don't know how many people would put themselves into a potentially dangerous situation like that while being completely unaware of the risk. But she did it, and what she found would forever haunt her. Latasha entered the home of 3844 Morning Spring Trail, where her 32-year-old neighbor, Levita Armstead, lived with her three children. Since the older of the two were at her house, Latasha needed to find where Levita and her 6-year-old daughter, Jasmine, were. As she walked through the house, still on the phone with the dispatcher, she called out Levita's name several times, but each call was met with silence. Nothing looked out of the ordinary, but the absolute stillness of the house was foreboding to say the least, and Latasha's fear mounted with every step she took. When she approached the master bedroom, that's when she saw that something absolutely horrible happened there. As soon as she reached the bedroom, she saw Levita lying face up on the floor, perpendicular to her bed. She was covered and surrounded by blood. It was obvious she was deceased. Latasha, now panicking herself, relayed what she saw to the dispatcher. Levita wasn't breathing and her lips were purple. It was at this point when the terror that had been building inside Latasha finally bubbled over, and she told the dispatcher that she couldn't find Jasmine, but she had to get out of that place. She didn't want to stick around to find out who had killed Levita. Shocked, Horrified and grief-stricken, Latasha walked back to her house and grabbed the boys in a tight embrace. Her heart just crumbled for them. There really were no words that she could say, so she just continued to hold them. At about 9:30, homicide detectives were dispatched to the Morning Spring Trail address to begin their investigation. Detective Robert Kirk told producers for the Same ID Channel show that his first impression of the house was that it appeared to be a typical middle-class Dallas family home. It was neat, clean, and organized. The furnishings were nice and comfortable looking, and it just had a normal all-American feel to it. In the kitchen, it was apparent there had been plans to cook dinner because a package of chicken sat on the counter next to the sink, but it didn't look like anything had been cooked yet. The detectives continued their survey of the house, and just like Latasha, as soon as they darkened the master bedroom doorway, they could see LaVita's body on the floor. She was lying fully clothed, almost like she'd slid off the edge of her bed and landed on her back. She was right in front of her nightstand, and her legs were spread out with her feet just in front of her ensuite bathroom entryway. Blood was everywhere, the bed, the nightstand, on and around LaVita. It was obvious to detectives that she had been stabbed to death multiple times. Now, standing over LaVita, it was impossible not to see that inside the bathroom lay another grisly and unforgettable sight. The bathroom floor was also painted with blood. It was all over the walls, the tub, the sink, just everywhere, pools and smears of it. And there, just in front of the bathtub, was little Jasmine. Her hands had been bound behind her back, and her feet were taped together with duct tape. She was also deceased, but her body didn't appear to have any noticeable trauma like her mother's did, so detectives weren't exactly sure what her cause of death was. All they knew was that she had also been murdered. Detectives could tell by looking at both rooms that one hell of a struggle took place within those walls because drawers were pulled open with the contents hanging out of them. Other things were on the floor that shouldn't have been there, like a bloody roll of tissue by the toilet. Clothes were strewn about the bedroom. Items on the countertops and dressers were knocked over. And amid the chaos was a bloody knife. In front of the bathroom floor mat, diagonal to the bottom right corner, next to the roll of toilet paper, was a broken knife handle. And underneath the mat, of the upper left side corner was the serrated butcher knife that had apparently become detached from the handle during the stabbing of LaVita. Horrified by such a horrific crime scene, detectives really wanted to know who did this to LaVita and her precious baby girl. As they continued to look around the bedroom, they could see that in the middle of the bed were three blood-stained letters. Two of them were written by LaVita and were addressed to her 37-year-old husband, Gary Green. The letters explained in short that their brief marriage was over and it was best they went their separate ways. LaVita expressed that she simply wanted to move on with her life along with her three children and she wanted to get their marriage annulled. Now, Gary was not their father, so she just wanted to cut things and move on. The third letter was in response to LaVita's letters and appeared to be written by Gary. For such beautiful penmanship, the words written were violent, hateful, and full of rage. Gary wrote in detail that there would be no annulment, and if LaVita wanted out of their marriage, he'd take her out, along with her three children, and then himself. He wrote that if she wanted to see the monster he blamed her for being, now she would. It was clear who the prime suspect was in this investigation, and detectives knew they needed to find Gary. But before they started looking for him, they wanted to question the witnesses, especially JT and Jarrett. The boys told detectives that they'd been in school all day and followed that up by attending Bible study, and later returned home that evening after they were picked up by Gary. When they got home, like everyone else who would later walk into the house, there was no indication that something was wrong. JT said as he walked down the hallway, his brother, who should have been right behind him, began to scream. It was a terrified scream, and it caused JT to stop in his tracks and turn around to see what scared Jarrett so much. The sight before his eyes caused his throat to clamp up, and it was hard for him to breathe. Jarrett's shirt collar was gripped in one of Gary's hands, while the other hand wielded a giant knife. Gary forcibly walked the boy down the hall while yelling at him. JT told the producers for the ID show that the look in Gary's eyes was dark and fierce, like he was ready to use that knife. That look terrified him. Gary forced both boys into the bedroom and then closed and locked the door. When he faced the children, he told them, quote, "Now give me a reason I shouldn't kill y'all," end quote. The boys sat on the bed watching Gary pace in front of them while holding the knife. These kids were scared out of their minds, and who wouldn't be? They didn't know what to think or do, but they knew that Gary's question wasn't rhetorical. He actually wanted an answer, but the kids were too terrified to speak. Then Jarrett gathered the courage to answer him, and before the words could fully leave his mouth, Gary erupted in anger, yelling, "Shut up!" at him. Then he jabbed the knife into Jarrett's abdomen. At this point, JT was shocked. He couldn't believe what just happened in front of his eyes, and now his brother sat next to him with blood spreading through his t-shirt. Even though he was in disbelief, the violence enacted on his little brother compelled him to rush to his feet and shove Gary with all of the 12-year-old strength he could muster to get the monster away from him. Now, Gary is a huge 6'3", 365-pound man, so it's not like the shove sent him flying across the room, but it was enough to break whatever crazy spell Gary's brain was under at that moment. At the same time, Jarrett somehow had the presence of mind to use that break to try to convince Gary that he and his brother were too young to die. He said that if Gary loved them, he wouldn't kill them, and that if he just let them go, they wouldn't tell anyone what happened. He basically was trying to talk himself and his brother out of that violent situation, all while only being 9 years old, and after having been stabbed. And miraculously, his pleading worked. Gary stopped threatening the boys and suddenly told them to get up because he wanted to show them something. As soon as he opened the bedroom door, across the hall, the kids could clearly see their mom's body on the floor. He described their mom's skin as looking discolored, more purple than the pretty brown it once was. JT ran to his mom and cried over her body, in shock that she met such a brutal end, obviously, by Gary's hands. JT said he began to shut down emotionally at that point and cried harder and harder. He tried to convince himself that this was all some horrible nightmare, and then he looked behind him into the adjoining bathroom and saw his baby sister's lifeless body lying on the bathroom floor, surrounded by their mother's blood. It was at that moment when JT went to a completely different state of mind and level of breakdown inside. The brutality of it all was just too much for his young mind. Just then, Gary just stood there, looking at both of the traumatized children, telling them that he loved their mom, quote-unquote, to death. Then he did something unexpected. He handed them their mother's phone and told them to call the police after he was gone. He told the boys, quote, "You know how I always say, see you later and never goodbye? Well, this is goodbye," end quote. And with that, Gary left the house and drove off. That's when Jarrett dialed 911 and the boys ran to Latasha's house. The boys also told police that Gary was abusive to them and their mom pretty much as soon as he moved in with them. It was a gradual progression of abuse, but considering they'd only been together for about a year, things escalated pretty fast. Life after he moved in changed in such a drastic way that everyone in the house was on edge. But even still, LaVita and Gary got married. Once that happened, Gary felt like he was the man of the house, in control of everyone and everything within it. JT described Gary as the type of man who wanted to be feared and respected, and it didn't take much to set him off before he'd start beating the kids. He didn't even care or even notice where he hit them. If the blows landed on their butts, their stomachs, their faces, it mattered not to him. LaVita tried to run interference as much as she could and console her children, but it was obvious she was being abused as well. There was an incident that resulted in LaVita going to the hospital, and when she returned home, she had a casted leg and was on crutches. She never told anyone what exactly happened that caused her broken leg, but her children intuitively knew it was Gary. Whenever anyone would ask her about it or bring it up at all, it would be the elephant in the room, and she tried to change the subject. One thing that was known for sure was that Gary's violence was escalating, and as it did, LaVita's fear did too. When the detectives interviewed Latasha, she was able to provide them with more information regarding who LaVita was as a person and what her relationship with Gary was like. LaVita was a devoted, educated, doting single mother to her children. She was a teacher at a local school, and she was an incredibly positive, happy, fun-loving, sassy woman. She was always smiling and just enjoyed her life. She met Gary in 2008 and just a few months later agreed to allow him to move into her home. Latasha didn't think Gary was good enough for LaVita. In fact, she believed lovely BBW LaVita could do so much better than him, and she couldn't understand why LaVita chose him. She was beautiful, friendly, and successful, so Latasha didn't understand what LaVita saw in Gary. He wasn't successful and didn't seem particularly smart, and he definitely wasn't friendly. As my friend Sine would say, their cutes and everything else just didn't match. Like the kids said during their interviews, Latasha noticed things were amiss in the house as soon as Gary moved in. She'd often hear Gary's booming voice all the way into her house as he screamed at the kids or LaVita. It was obvious to her that he was abusive, but like so many people, Latasha was reluctant to get involved and ultimately did not call the police or CPS. She was really concerned about separating LaVita from her children, even though Gary was the problem that threatened them. She just continued to do her best and support her neighbor and her children without involving state entities. Now the detectives had more background information on Gary and his relationship with LaVita and the children, the manhunt ensued. Though he was on the run, police were confident he'd be found, and they were counting on his big size to give him away. At 6'3", 365 pounds, it wasn't going to be easy for him to keep a low profile while police searched for him. The big issue they were worried about, though, was his unpredictable behavior if he was spotted or when caught. Thankfully, they didn't have to worry or wonder for long because the very next day, on September 22nd, Gary's family found him at a friend's house. Now, here's where the source information becomes conflicting. In the Evil Lives Here show, Detective Kirk said that Gary's mom found him at a friend's house, and his family called the police, and Gary willingly turned himself in. But Meredith Schamberger reported for the Dallas Morning News that Gary had taken 20 to 30 pills in an effort to kill himself at that friend's house. When he was discovered, his family called the authorities and he was escorted to the hospital where they treated him for a drug overdose. In either scenario, thankfully, he was taken into custody. But can you imagine if he'd actually killed himself? I know it would be one less evil person, but it really melts my ice cream when these weak cowards dole out violent, agonizing deaths like the one LaVita and Jasmine suffered, only to kill themselves in the end. I'd much rather they be brought to justice and then taken out like the trash they are, but that's just me. Anyway, I digress. Eventually, following his arrest, Gary was able to give detectives his account of what happened that terrible day, and what he had to say was chilling. Hey folks, listen up. I want to tell you about this amazing service called OneRep. OneRep removes your private information from Google and more than 150 people search sites. If you've ever gone through the painstaking task of requesting for those people search sites like PeopleFinder to remove your information, then you know firsthand how sucky that is. And if you haven't done it before, then you're leaving your privacy up for grabs. Herein enters OneRep. OneRep will do all the heavy lifting for you so that you never have to bother sending in any letters of request or submitting a form online. They even send you a detailed report every month that tells you exactly how many sites your information has been found on, how many sites it has been removed from, and how many more are left to go. And here's the best part for me. You can even protect your family of up to 6 people by choosing OneRep's family plan. This is what I use to protect my family's privacy, and I could not be happier. So I want to extend this offer for you to try OneRep for yourself and get up to 60% off. You heard that right. I said 60%. Not 5, not 10, but 60. Take advantage of this discount and click on the link in the show notes to start securing your privacy today. Shortly before the murders, Gary was already out of LaVita's home and had been for several days. However, on the 21st, he got in touch with LaVita and begged her to let him spend the day with her at the house. And for whatever reason, LaVita agreed. I imagine that she thought it was best to have that tough conversation about ending their marriage face to face, and I can't fault her for that. As I said, she was a kind and mature person. I can guess that she thought this was the right thing to do, the proper way to end things. Gary expressed to the investigators that he was frustrated that LaVita, quote, always tried to control him, end quote, and that it's a man's place to be in control. He said that she wrote the letter saying she was done with the relationship and wanted to live her life without him. Insulted and enraged, that's when he decided to go after little Jasmine. He wanted to exert control over LaVita by using her daughter as a weapon against her. So he grabbed a cord and some heavy-duty tape and tied Jasmine's hands behind her back and taped her feet together. Once the child was bound, he carried her into LaVita's bedroom and put her on the bed. At this point, LaVita is screaming and trying to convince him to stop and release Jasmine. But the more she begged, the more Gary felt empowered to continue his torment. Now that Gary felt he had LaVita's undivided attention, he turned his focus to her while Jasmine watched terrified from the bed. That's when he began attacking LaVita. Now, she put up one hell of a fight, as evidenced by the absolute disarray the bathroom and bedroom were in. She fought so much and so hard that somehow she did manage to get her hands on the knife and stabbed him twice in the back of his shoulder. But unfortunately, despite her absolute best efforts, Gary's huge size and strength overpowered her. He stabbed Levita over and over again, so many times that he couldn't be sure how many times he actually stabbed her. He guessed it was about 30 times. His attack against Levita was so violent that he broke one knife and continued stabbing her with a second. Eventually, sweet and sassy Levita succumbed to her multiple injuries and bled to death in front of her daughter. I cannot imagine the absolute horror that baby witnessed. The sounds that she must have heard, even if she managed to close her little eyes, just make my skin crawl when I think about it. To be so young and innocent and completely bound, unable to escape, forced to watch, surely must have thrust her young mind into shock. Honestly, I hope at some point she did lose some type of consciousness and blacked out or something, because the thought of her being completely cognizant during her mom's murder is entirely too much to bear. Bless her heart. And bless that baby's soul. Once Levita was gone, Gary went into the bathroom and filled the bathtub with water. He then returned to the bedroom, grabbed Jasmine, and drowned her in the tub. The coward couldn't even bear the sight of his own actions, even while committing the atrocity. So he turned his head and averted his eyes while he forced that baby to drown. Like I said, a fucking coward. At any point, he could have stopped the carnage and come to his senses. If he couldn't handle watching Jasmine die, then that was his opportunity to stop, but he refused. He told Detective Kirk that he'd, quote, never seen anything like that in real life, only on TV, end quote. After Jasmine died, he just laid her body on the floor against the tub, and then he proceeded to take a shower in that very same tub, as if that precious baby's body wasn't right there. He literally had to step over her to get in and out of the tub, not to mention all the blood that completely covered the bathroom floor. It's unfathomable that he just showered and got himself dressed as if nothing happened. But that's exactly what he did. Once he was dressed, he went to pick up the boys from Bible school, and that's when their particular nightmare began. He also told detectives that he heard voices that told him to kill Levita and the children because they were quote-unquote plotting against him. He was convinced that if he killed them, they would somehow all be reunited in heaven as a happy family. You know, this story actually reminds me a lot of the murders of Lene and Ava Mouton. I did an episode about them some time back. Louis, the husband to Lene and father of Ava, killed them and also claimed demons told him to do it, and that if he did, they would all be together in the afterlife. It's shockingly scary how similar these stories are and how common that theme is. Anyway, with Gary's confession fully documented, he was locked up where he awaited trial, which began on October 26, 2010. And if convicted, he faced the death penalty. During the trial, JT and Jarrett testified about what they witnessed and experienced a year prior on that terrible September night. The jury heard about the horrors they saw that day and about the abuse they'd endured up to that point. Gary's criminal record was also a discussion point. In 1989, at just 18 years old, Gary was convicted of possession of cocaine and sentenced to 4 years probation. Then, the next year, his high school girlfriend, whom I'll call Jessica, broke up with him, but later saw him standing at a bus stop and, out of the kindness of her heart, offered him a ride, not thinking that act of kindness would put her life at risk. Instead of declining the offer or simply behaving like a decent human being, Gary forced Jessica into the passenger seat of her own car and drove her to a nearby park where he proceeded to strangle her with his shoelaces and then stabbed her in the chest. I guess he had a moment of clarity, thank God, because he ended up driving her to the hospital where he lied and told people Jessica had been robbed. Nobody bought that story, and thankfully Jessica survived to tell the tale. He was eventually convicted of robbery and aggravated assault and was sentenced to 20 years for that. Now, I don't know how much of that 20-year sentence he actually served, but he got out at some point and managed to grossly abuse yet another woman. I'll call this woman Rashonda, and she was pregnant with Gary's son at the time when he beat and strangled her with a cord until she lost consciousness. Thankfully, she also survived, and both women testified against Gary during the murder trial, highlighting the fact that he has always been a danger to society, but to women in particular. And surprise, surprise, this beast has a violent history with women. It's unknown whether or not Levita was aware of Gary's criminal and violent history, but it was the first time her family became aware of it, and they don't believe that Levita knew. The defense, unable to claim innocence, really tried to lay it on extra heavy that Gary had a rough life and was mentally disabled. Apparently, his childhood was one filled with mental illness and extreme abuse by the hands of his own father. He not only suffered the abuse, but he watched his father badly abuse his mom too. Younger brother Nisosno Carter also testified that while Gary had never been diagnosed, he always suspected that Gary had serious mental issues. Nisosno said that Gary would often talk about how he had nothing to live for, and naturally this was troublesome. When he'd try to talk to his mother about those concerns, she'd just brush them off, and thus Gary never got the professional help he obviously needed. Nisosno also testified that just before the murders, Gary checked himself into a mental institution where he was kept for 5 days, but ultimately requested to be released. A psychologist testified that although Gary wasn't intellectually disabled, he does have a low IQ at about 78 or 79, making him borderline disabled. The doctor also testified that Gary suffers from schizoaffective bipolar disorder, which would cause him to experience paranoid delusions as well as mania and depression. The psychologist did want it known on the record that his testimony was in no way, shape, or form meant to absolve Gary of his crimes, but rather to explain his mental state in general. At one point during the trial, the state brought forth a video of Little Jasmine talking animatedly about being a Black American. She wore her big, pretty smile and delivered her speech just as sassy and spunky as JT remembered their mom being. Jasmine looked just like a mini version of Levita and was like her in so many ways. This video was introduced as a way for the jury to hear Jasmine speak for herself and to remind them just how much had been stolen by Gary. By the time the tape stopped rolling, there was hardly a dry eye in the courtroom. The trial was swift, with so much evidence stacked against Gary that there was no need to drag it out, and on November 5th, 2010, he was found guilty of both Levita and Jasmine's murders and was sentenced to death just 2 days later. He's been on death row all these years, filing appeal after appeal. The basis for his appeals basically are that he's, one, mentally disabled and thus making him ineligible for the death penalty, and two, that his attorney failed to properly defend him. Now, he's applied for funding for an investigation to prove he was done wrong in court multiple times, but each effort has been stricken down and his conviction and subsequent sentence both upheld. The most recent and final appeal was denied in 2021. And get this, Action Network, an advocacy group that seeks clemency and pardons for death row inmates, has circulated a petition asking the governor to stay Gary's execution or offer clemency. And this isn't even the worst part. The shocking part to me is that there are actually 2,142 people out there who signed the petition, even though it clearly states what exactly earned Gary the death penalty in the first place. Like, what in the actual hell is wrong with people? I mean, yes, he has mental issues, but I'm sorry, the man has been a menace to society practically his whole life. And yeah, he was dealt a bad hand, but you know what? So were LaVita and Jasmine and Jessica and Rashonda. So I say carry on, Texas, and please do us all a favor and take out the trash. Sorry, not sorry. Lots of people have mental issues, and they aren't running around stabbing and strangling women in front of their children and drowning little girls. Obviously, Texas is unbothered by his advocacy and lame appeals because Gary was executed on March 7th, 2023, and he had these final words to say. Quote, Vita, Jared, Ray, I'm sorry. No, I'm not sorry. I apologize for all the harm I've caused you and your family. We ate together. We broke bread together. We laughed and cried together as a family. I'm sorry I failed you. There's nothing I can do. I'm not just saying that because I'm laying here on this gurney. We were all one and I broke that bond, right or wrong. I took not one but two people that we all loved and I had to live with that while I was here. I ask that you forgive me, not for me, but for y'all. I'm fixing to go home and y'all are going to be here. I want to make sure you don't suffer. You have to forgive me to heal and move on. Sorry, JT. I always loved you and I told you I would never say goodbye, but this is goodbye. There's nothing I can do to bring your mom and sister back. One thing about the man I used to be is that I never stopped loving y'all. See y'all on the other side. God bless you. I'm done, Warden. End quote. And finally, some true justice. I know it won't bring back what's been lost for LaVita, Jasmine, and the boys, who are now grown men with children of their own. In fact, watching that interview with JT just broke my heart because he talked about how hard life has been for him, full of fear, distrust, and depression. He said the murders of his mom and sister horribly impacted his life and all of his relationships, and he even attempted suicide. You can just see the sorrow in his eyes and hear it in his voice. I often think about the family left behind in the wake of extreme violence, and seeing and hearing JT brought all those victims to the surface for me. Because when people are murdered, it doesn't just impact them. It causes a ripple effect to everyone associated, everyone in the community, everyone who knew them. Those people are left with massive holes in their lives and in their hearts. And no matter what happens, nothing can fill the voids left behind. This story is such a profound tragedy and one too often repeated in our community. LaVita and her children's story is one that needs to be told and remembered for a number of reasons. Naturally, the first is that Levita and Jasmine were real people, and their murders caused a ripple effect that will last generations. It already has. The second is that when Levita tried to end things, fatal violence ensued, and sadly demonstrated what the statistics pointed out and that I mentioned earlier. Victims are in the most danger when they try to leave the abuser, and you can multiply that when children are involved. Again, Gary demonstrated another fact that abusers will use anything, including children, as leverage against their primary victim. Now, I'm going to be honest that my knee-jerk reaction was to ask why Levita let Gary back in the house. I'm human, like everyone else, so from time to time, I do ask those questions, but I almost always follow them up immediately with the corrected question. And I force myself to remember that no matter what happened, or in this case, no matter what Levita did or didn't do, short of successfully escaping by the grace of God, this same outcome or worse could have and probably would have happened. JT even said in an interview that his mom knew they needed to get free, but she had to take care while trying. That meant waiting until she felt safe enough to make a move. So the questions in my mind change and shift focus onto the perpetrator's actions, which is really where attention should be. Gary has the onus in this story, not Levita. So the new question is, why did he have to kill her? Or why did he have to kill Jasmine? Why did he have to attack the boys? Why did he check out of the mental institution? The whys could go on and on forever, but they cannot be framed in a way that implies the victims were responsible for what happened. We have to remember that it is never their fault. Never. So I want you to remember that, and I'm always going to remind you because I think it's really important to keep that focus right where it needs to be. Also, I think I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that while Gary did something awful and unforgivable, he did suffer from extreme mental health issues. This is where the intersection of violence and mental health issues occurs, and we can't talk about this story without at least mentioning that. I know, but it's not lost on me that we have a serious mental health crisis in this country that runs the gamut of mild to profound and deeply disturbing issues. Sometimes people can get help and other times they can't or even won't. In Gary's case, he did try, and the sources vary on whether or not he checked himself out of the mental institution he was in prior to the murders, or whether they improperly diagnosed him and then released him. I did read more than once that he was improperly diagnosed, but it wasn't until he was executed did I read that it was during that particular stay at the hospital when he was first misdiagnosed and subsequently released. So I'm not sure which version is true, but regardless, the issue of his mental health is a huge part of the story and the stories of Americans across the country. I don't have the answers, but I know that as a community, it is critical that we advocate for mental health resources and then get the help we need. Easier said than done, of course, I know this, because thanks to systemic racism, medical professionals almost always want to put our needs and issues on the back burner or diminish their impact or misdiagnose us altogether. It literally happens across the board every single day, and again, this is another very sad example of one of many issues we face. As always, thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out the new website and to subscribe and turn notifications on so you never miss an episode. Also, it's been a while since I asked, but please do leave a review for the podcast on whatever platform you may be listening. When you give a positive review, it helps this podcast grow and reach more listeners, which is exactly what we need. Thank you for your continuous support, and I'll catch you next time on Massage Noir Murders. This is a Savvy Sounds production, written and produced by Renetta Rideout.